From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Grelott, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Rebecca Cruz and I talk about the dispute between Norway and the International Olympic Committee, and the release of an American prisoner in North Korea after Kim Jong-un's weeks-long absence from the public spotlight.
So this probably is not coincidental that he comes back, that he's making the declaration and showing that he has the power to, as he essentially said, give a favor to President Obama.
Later, I'm joined by Jean Preston, who worked for the State Department during Guatemala's nearly four-decade civil war. She says the U.S. Embassy often served as the one place where indigenous leaders, private sector executives, and government officials could peacefully meet.
I would hear back the next week from people from all different sides saying, "Where did you find those interesting people, and how could I meet them again?"
The power of diplomacy, right after this hour's news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelott. Rebecca Cruz, let's talk about a couple of interesting issues this week. Norway rejects an opportunity to bid for the 2022 Winter Olympics in Oslo. Interestingly, they didn't suggest that it was only because of the expense of taking on the Olympics. Now, we all know that this is a very expensive endeavor. I mean, you have to build lots of stadiums, and the cost of taking on those Olympics is huge. But not just that, it's the kind of unusual and kind of outrageous, excessive requests that were being made, reportedly, by the International Olympic Committee, the IOC. The things that they needed to have in place, things like we have to have special lanes to drive our cars, there has to be a car and a driver at the beck and call of every single IOC member. They have to be greeted at the airport by the president. They demanded a reception with the king at the expense of Norway. Bars had to be stocked. Food had to be rotated. Even things like, I show up to the hotel, I have to be greeted with a smile. So this is kind of laughable in some ways, but indicative of a corrupt IOC. Their reputation definitely precedes them on this. But what are we to make of this now that Norway has, you know, the perfect candidate for a Winter Olympics has backed out?
Well, it is kind of humorous, as you say, and this is really the first time that we have been able to see these requests, demands, however you want to phrase it. The IOC, of course, is saying this is just requests that are included in a 1,000-plus page document that they send out to these cities that want to host. But Oslo is actually the third city that has pulled out in the last year. Some other natural selections would be Krakow that pulled out in May, I believe. And they did that based mainly on costs, though you could think of these requests as well. But they did some polling, some public opinion polling, and found that 70% of the citizens were against hosting the Olympics. Stockholm also pulled out last December, also citing cost concerns. Really pointing to Sochi and how expensive Sochi was, $50 billion estimated. And also some of the corruption charges or issues of corruptions that you mentioned. A lot of people in Western Europe, in these places in particular, look to Sochi, look to the IOC, and see a lot of elites that are in charge of these things. And then you throw these kind of outlandish requests on top of it. And that only confirms the idea that this isn't a transparent process. The host city goes to the biggest bidder, and it's not the bidder in terms of the city, but what they can provide to these individuals.
Well, this leaves two candidates for the 2022 Olympic Games, Winter Olympic Games, Almaty in Kazakhstan and Beijing in China. So two authoritarian countries, governments that apparently don't have a problem with public spending of this sort directed toward these kinds of activities, but also maybe taking on these other types of corrupt or other excessive demands, that this is something that they seem to be able to stomach, where perhaps democracies, and particularly social democracies in the northern part of Europe, won't take on.
I think that's one of the concerns, is that we're going to see more and more of these countries that are going to be getting these large sporting events, the Winter Olympics, Summer Olympics, or even the World Cup, because these are cities that are willing to do the massive overhaul of their infrastructures, to put in the money, and perhaps to go along with some of these requests. But China and Kazakhstan are not necessarily good choices either. If we look at Beijing, they're talking about having to do these skiing events 100 miles away and having to build a new rail system just to get there, a fast-speed rail system. And then Kazakhstan obviously has a human rights record that we're not too proud of or wouldn't want to endorse, so perhaps that doesn't come into the calculation. So we'll see what happens there.
The international politics of the Olympics is something we always are interested in. Well, to another part of the world, North Korea. released an American prisoner this week. I think it took everyone by surprise. No one was expecting it. And apparently the United States government didn't intervene and ask. I mean, we've been asking for the release of three prisoners that are actually Americans that are in prison in North Korea. So this prisoner, Jeffrey Pham, had been in jail there for almost 6 months. He was arrested when he traveled there as a tourist, which is interesting, and then left a Bible in a bar, a sailor's club, they called it, I guess, in North Korea. Kim Jong-un apparently, or reportedly, ordered the release and did so when he reemerged from a six-week absence from the public. So an interesting development here all the way around, Kim Jong-un coming back into the public and then announcing that an American prisoner would be released.
Yeah, this feels somewhat suspicious, though, again, we're talking about North Korea, so we never really know what the motivations are or what's going on there. But this would happen on the heels of him walking back into the public light after really weeks of speculation as to his health, who was in charge. There was some talk that his sister was actually leading the country. So this probably is not coincidental that he comes back, that he's making the declaration and showing that he has the power to, as he essentially said, give a favor to President Obama, that he did this because President Obama requested it. And you mentioned that there are two others that are there. One has only been there for a couple months, but there is another gentleman, Kenneth Bay, who's been in prison since 2012 and has actually been convicted and will serve, unless he is released at some time, a 15-year sentence. So they really are pushing to get him and this other gentleman released as well. But this was a bit of a surprise, and Secretary Kerry has come out and said that, you know, we welcome this. We're happy to see Pham be back with his family after 6 months in really what we can imagine be deplorable conditions, but that this was not a quid pro quo, that the United States did not bargain this, did not give anything up to this. And so perhaps this is a thawing of relations. We've seen some other steps in that direction as well. While Kim Jong-un was away, some officials went to South Korea and talked about opening up negotiations or extending negotiations. And interestingly enough, North Korea has also agreed to look into some suspicious kidnappings or deaths of Japanese citizens a couple of decades ago. So perhaps signaling that they're willing to be a partner, or at least a member at the table to discuss moving forward.
Well, considering North Korea's past, this certainly seems to be a bit of a change, but I guess it's still too early to suggest that we are seeing much of a thaw or that this will lead to better relations, but certainly something that we will be keeping our eye on. So thank you very much, Rebecca, as always, for being here.
Thank you.
Let us know if you have any questions or thoughts about these discussions. This program is on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU, and Rebecca and I tweet at Cruz226 and at Suzette Guerlot. Coming up, I'm joined by Gene Preston, a longtime State Department official who most recently served as the University of Oklahoma's diplomat in residence. I'm Suzette Guerlot, and you're listening to Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Guerlot. My guest, Gene Preston, joined the U.S. State Department in 1986. She spent most of her career in Latin America. While in Guatemala, she led initiatives to promote transparent elections, advance human rights, and combat human trafficking. She also spent time in Peru, Venezuela, and Italy. She most recently served in Norman as the University of Oklahoma's diplomat in residence. Each year, the U.S. Department of State assigns senior foreign service officers to posts at colleges and universities around the country. Gene Preston, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you so much.
So I always like to start just by asking, how did you end up in the Foreign Service? What led you down that path to seek out the Foreign Service? Because you've spent a good number of years there and have done some really incredible things. Tell us how you even got there.
Well, the short version is that when I was 10, I read a novel called The Ugly American, which I had picked up at a garage sale. And I said, gosh, wouldn't that be a great job? I get to travel around the world, represent the United States, meet all kind of interesting people, get to learn about their cultures, explain our culture and our government to them. I wonder how I get to do that. And 13 years later, I was joining the Foreign Service.
Well, not many people can explain their career choices from a book they picked up at a garage sale. That's pretty amazing. But so once you join the Foreign Service, you've obviously served in, what, about six different countries or so, approximately, and a couple different continents. But you spent a lot of time in Guatemala, and in particular, leading projects that I think many of us find very interesting, human rights projects, rule of law projects. I mean, and as we know a little bit about Guatemala, it's a troubled country. So can you tell us a little bit about your time there and some of the projects that you led and kind of where is Guatemala heading today?
Well, Guatemala emerged from a 36-year internal conflict in 1996. Shortly after that, they began negotiations for the Central American Free Trade Agreement. And there's been a lot of hope that the country would heal. It is healing, but I think not as quickly as everyone would like. An important part of that healing is the rule of law. There's justice and there's reconciliation, the two sides of the healing process. Part of what we did was just to support all the institutions that are essential to the rule of law, from forensics, you know, fingerprints, tracking ballistics, to the judicial system, to police training, investigation. We and other members of the international community support the International Commission Against Impunity in Guatemala, which is led by the UN, which has also had a very important role. The selection of Attorney General Claudia Paz y Paz was a tremendous step forward. She was a former human rights advocate, very effective and very principled. So all those things together made a big difference, I think.
Well, you mentioned healing and reconciliation. It seems to me that this is often the trickiest thing to really manage in a country, as you said, that experienced 36 years of civil war with a tremendous amount of atrocity. So, I mean, how is it? I mean, you mentioned rule of law and all of these, you know, the justice system and having good leaders. But how do you actually facilitate reconciliation, which involves forgiveness, right? I mean, Jean, how can U.S. government officials help people forgive each other in these kinds of war-torn countries?
Well, it's not easy. It's not easy for them, and there are limits to what the U.S. can do. But one of the interesting things that the U.S. can do is just to be a sort of neutral ground where people can meet each other, people who might otherwise not get to meet each other in a society that can be very divided. There were times when I felt as if the U.S. ambassador's residence in Guatemala was the one place where people from very different backgrounds, from indigenous leaders to private sector leaders to union leaders to human rights activists to government officials could all meet and get to know each other as individuals. And in fact, sometimes after we invited a very diverse group of people to the residence, I would hear back the next week from people from all different sides saying, where did you find those interesting people and how could I meet them again? And one of the things that I found most encouraging is that there were different fora that emerged in which Guatemalans decided that they would like to continue meeting each other across those sectors and trying to find a way to bridge the divide.
This has got to be the most challenging work ever. But as far as the future of Guatemala, I mean, if you still look at the statistics, it's still rather unstable. There's still high rates of homicide. I mean, it's still a concerning place in Central America. I mean, are you hopeful that Guatemala is on the right path and healing as it should?
I am hopeful. When I arrived in Guatemala, it had the eighth highest murder rate in the world. And that declined substantially from over 40 per 100,000 per year down to 32, 34 by the time that I left. That was just 3 years. Yes, the numbers are still bad, but the trend was in the right direction. It is tough to be fighting drug trafficking and gangs. Those are terrible influences, and it's a challenge that we share in the U.S., and it's something we work with the Guatemalan government to try to combat. Another trend that I think is important is the government's efforts to combat child malnutrition. Guatemala has some of the highest rates of child malnutrition, chronic malnutrition, in the world. Almost 50% of the children under four are chronically malnourished. So the government has introduced a program called Zero Hunger, with an emphasis on the first 1,000 days, because if you can give a child adequate nutrition in the first 1,000 days of their life, it can have impact through the rest of their lives in terms of brain development, physical development, success in school. And the U.S. Feed the Future program, which is administered by both the Agency for International Development and the U.S. Department of Agriculture, has worked closely with the Guatemalan government in that initiative.
I'm speaking with Jean Preston, who most recently served as the U.S. State Department's diplomat in residence at the University of Oklahoma. We'll talk more right after a short break. I'm Suzette Gorelot, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorelot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. I'm speaking this half hour with Jean Preston, a longtime diplomat who just completed a post as the University of Oklahoma's diplomat in residence. She spent 3 years in Guatemala as their decades-long civil war came to an end, and told me just before the break she's optimistic about the country's declining murder rate and efforts to combat childhood malnutrition. Well, I want to switch gears just a little bit and move from Guatemala to one of your other postings. And in fact, I think you had two different postings in Italy before you went to Guatemala.
Correct.
So tell us a little bit about your time in Italy. But I'm particularly interested, and I think many people are, for foreign service officers. You know, you don't necessarily get to pick your assignments. You often go from one country to a completely different country. How is it, you know, as you tell us a little bit about your time in Italy and the things that you worked on there, how you then make that transition from an Italian experience and the Italian issues and U.S.-Italian relations to a very different context in Guatemala and working on a country, you know, working in a country that you have 36 years of history of conflict and a very different relationship with the United States?
One of the things that I spent a lot of time in Italy, both in my first tour there and my second tour there, were fisheries issues. I was it's called environment science, technology, and health officer. There are all kinds of international agreements as to what kind of fisheries gear countries will use and which ones they won't use in order to protect species like whales and sea turtles and dolphins. And fisheries is a very sensitive issue in almost any country. Fishermen like to fish the way they like to fish. And regulating it is something that can involve regional governments like the European Union, the Italian government, international agreements. So it comes down to rule of law. It comes down to how you help governments carry out the things that they have agreed to do. And whether that's fisheries, as in the case of Italy, or whether that's fulfilling labor commitments undertaken in the course of the Central American Free Trade Agreements, a lot of the mechanisms are the same. You need to work with the judiciary. You need to understand the other country's legal system. You need to see what concrete measures can be taken on the ground to make the commitments that those governments undertook a reality.
So this is a very interesting lesson, I think, for many of us, that despite the local context and the local issues and problems, there is one thing that really does motivate Foreign Service officers and U.S. government policy in any location, and that is this issue of rule of law and good governance and working to establish the best practices possible to best govern whatever issue we're facing in each country.
Correct. And to ensure a level playing field for U.S. companies and U.S. workers. When we negotiate international agreements, the idea is that we're all taking measures to make the world a better place, to defend the global commons, but that we all will take those measures. If someone is and someone is not, then the person who is taking those measures could be competitively disadvantaged. That's why we have international agreements, to make sure that we're all playing by the same rules. And the trick is in the enforcement of those commitments.
That is definitely the trick. Well, speaking of that issue, I guess, and kind of wrapping back into some of the things you've already said, you mentioned, for example, being an environmental officer when you were serving in Italy. That's your next post. You're going on to serve as in Washington, I believe, as an environmental officer, focusing on environmental issues and conservation issues. And so this seems to be a love of yours, right, Jean? This is something that you've spent many
Absolutely.
Years working on. And so tell us a little bit more about what you'll be doing in that respect. And how, in particular, that issue is so tricky when it comes to enforcing international law around the world.
The office I'll be going to is the Office of Conservation and Water in our Bureau of Oceans and International Environmental and Scientific Affairs. I'll be the deputy director of the office. And it's the office that works on terrestrial conservation, so combating wildlife trafficking, combating illegal logging, also promoting sustainable use of freshwater resources. And so these are the people who negotiate those international agreements that set the framework for our interactions on those areas. And I think one of the things that's important to keep in mind is that a lot of the species that we think of as ours are also other countries' species. The Baltimore Oriole spends half of its life in Venezuela and Central America. So any measure that we take to conserve Baltimore Orioles in the States will be ineffective if we're not working with the countries in whose habitat that oriole lives for the other half of its life. So whether we like those governments or not, if we want to preserve our species, we need to work with them.
Well, that's an excellent illustration, I think, of the transnational world in which we live, and that no one country, no one actor, no one player can address any one problem, that you have to do this multilaterally. Well, I just want to end, first of all, with a thank you. You spent the last year here in Norman with us in the University of Oklahoma, having a tremendous impact on our student body here. You've served as our diplomat in residence for the past year. We're really sorry to see you go. All you going on to do amazing things in the future, undoubtedly. But the student part of your work has really been quite incredible. And I think a lot of people don't understand that the State Department has a student-oriented program, such as Diplomat in Residence, where you're settled at a university and you work with students to help facilitate their future careers in the Foreign Service. So tell us a little bit about what you've done, some of the successes you've had as you've been spending the past year here with us.
Well, first of all, let me say I've had an absolutely wonderful time at OU. There's just been some wonderful faculty and students here. And I've been thrilled to see some of those students go on to take advantage of some of these wonderful opportunities that we have. And I'm delighted to say that this year there are three students from OU, one who received the Hispanic Association internship, one the Washington Internship for Native Students internship, another, a former OU grad who's been working out in the work world a bit, has received the Pickering Fellowship, and a student from Oklahoma City University is one of the Wrangles. So these are just wonderful opportunities, and at a time when people are looking for ways to pay for higher education, they provide a chance to get a foot into the work world and see this fascinating work that we do.
Well, these are great opportunities for our young people. But I think another thing to keep in mind is that the State Department isn't just looking for young people and college grads. There are lots of opportunities in technical fields, non-technical fields for people if they're thinking about a career change, too. Is this right?
Absolutely. We hire construction engineers, doctors, nurses, security specialists, information technology people. And we have a lot of second career people in the Foreign Service, both former military, folks who have worked in one career in the States but always wanted to run away and see the world, and folks that have gone overseas, seen what life is like, and are now looking for something relatively more stable. You wouldn't think of moving every 2 or 3 years and perhaps serving in Afghanistan or Iraq as being more stable, but for some folks, that is.
Well, Jean, thank you so much for being with us today on Worldviews to share your views. Obviously, your career has been an inspiration to many students and me and my colleagues here at OU. So thank you so much for what you've done and for being with us on Worldviews.
It's been a great pleasure.
You've been listening to my conversation with Jean Preston, a career Foreign Service officer in the U.S. State Department, who most recently served as the University of Oklahoma's diplomat in residence. You can find more information online at kgou.org. KGOU produces Worldviews through a partnership with the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Brian Hardzinski produces the show, Sarah Hurd and Hallie Arias handle our digital presence online, and Symphony Swift prepares the research for our interviews and books the guests. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Gralat.